Hello and welcome back to the exciting Stardub podcast, the podcast which talks about the aspects of pop culture which are either wisely or unfairly overlooked or under-discussed.
Or buried in concrete vaults never to see the light of day again.
Indeed. My name is Ralph.
I'm Andy.
So, first of all, we must resolve the exciting cliffhanger from the last episode. The exciting cliffhanger where Philip Ayres, the invisible silent member of the podcast, sent us a package. And in that package was Spawn the movie.
Yes.
Now, we're not going to be viewing this episode. It's in fact become an exciting story arc. When will we watch Spawn? Because we don't know when.
It depends how drunk, how bereft of other entertainment we are.
Remember, there is a slight twist to the saga. For I was in Phil's own house not 1 week but before this recording, and he exclaimed with glee his plan to get a Spawn and make us watch it. However, he let slip a dangerous piece of information. He has never seen Spawn himself. So I have decreed to him that once we view it, it will be sent to him. And when it does, I will try and get some comments from him to read out or possibly recorded for the podcast. So that's where that's going. Secondly, this is actually the very exciting Halloween special when you think about it.
Probably the time it airs.
Yes, so it's all totally Halloween themed and spectacular. Everything is completely 100% Halloween themed. In fact, we try to take a ghost from behind there. It's kind of what he looked like, kind of going for the buns. Anyway, so obviously everything here will be, the most amazing podcast ever dedicated to Halloween. The links to Halloween will be so strong, it's like they're invisible.
As tenuous as our segues are.
Yes.
It's also, more accurately, as we're recording, happens to be the weekend, sort of, basically the two greatest social events of the year.
It's true.
If you're in Birmingham, you'll be at the Birmingham Informal Gathering 4.
The Birmingham Informal Gathering that happened in the past?
Well, this is number 4. It's basically where a group of like-minded people go to Birmingham, do things on a slightly unplanned basis, usually involving second-hand bookshops, comic shops, comic fairs, zine fest, and also indulge in cocktails. So, normally we're there, but for reasons, well, several reasons, we can't be there, so we're having a satellite event here in Edinburgh.
This is
a small informal gathering.
Now, what we're referring to here is actually worthy of wider discussion, really, because we collect things, toys and the like. I mean, you know, I've actually...
Scorn,
yes. I mean, I've actually just purchased recently some Lego minifigure ice cube tray type items, which are being made into ice cubes as we talk. So, one of the cliches, of course, and I'm sure some of you may nod at this, is that our section of society is seen as having poor social skills.
Yeah.
We stay in basements.
Cellars.
We get covered in cobwebs and spooge and things. So we're referring to one of the many little gatherings that goes on up and down the UK and beyond, where people who are Transformers enthusiasts and alike get together, have a chinwag, and get drunk, even the ones that don't drink. So that's what's happening to some of our friends just now. But because we're amazing, we are committing to the social stereotype, we're staying together inside, all two of us, on our own, recording a podcast about toys and comics and the like.
We are, however, going to get drunk later.
It's true. So, talking on that, you may recall from previous podcasts my attempts to give up Transformers.
Which are... almost successful. I would say occasional relapse.
I had a relapse for Creel.
Yep.
And
I helped with that, I think.
Yes, the previous point. Creel, for those who don't know, is Hasbro's knockoff version of Lego, because Lego lost the patent for their particular brick building system a few years ago. So now various companies are putting out their own perfectly legal and legitimate version of Lego. What Lego still has the trademark for is their minifigures. So no one can quite copy the minifigure design. So the likes of Hasbro, Character Building, all that company that's done the Stargate ones, what are they called?
Oh, I can't remember.
We'll just call them Shit Brick Company. Best Lock, yes, because they make sets that turn up in Pound Stretcher on Poundland. And they look terrible and I won't buy them at some point. Anyway, so they make all these things. So there was the Creole Transformers. And I didn't like them because the pattern of the Lego bricks is you've got all the little studs on the top, right? And all the little studs are filled in. Well, on each piece of Creo, one of the little studs isn't filled in, and that upset me. I didn't like
it. I imagine that's more to, not, that's to get around the... Well, Lego will have lost the trademark.
Yes.
Sorry, the patent. They will not have lost the trademark on the design, which means that if Creo and Character were to do exactly the same mm-hmm. style of brick in exactly the same way, Lego would have their arses in court very, very quickly and would win and get lots of money.
And never fuck with the Danish, because then we'd have no more pastries.
Or bacon.
Or bacon, yes. Hurdy-gurdy-gurdy. Anyway, that was my Danish accent.
I thought you were doing the Swedish chef.
No.
I was about to backhand you for geographical ineptitude.
No, the Swedish chef is... This is the Swedish chef.
Don't have a rumble.
Put the microwave, put the chicken in the microwave, make the burger.
That's dreadful. That's awful. Have you watched the Muppets ever?
That's it.
You sound like John Major from Zero Energy Band.
No. Going to have some chicken.
Oh my God, stop that.
Whereas the Danish speak like this. Hurdy gurdy gurdy, got the Lego brick. Hello, Danish.
That's Jesus Christ.
That's how they talk. Anyway, so back to the topic at hand.
Please.
Creo Transformers. Right. I tried them, and the minifigure design is abhorrent shite. I hate the minifigure design. Absolutely. I'll tell you why I don't like it, because the key to minifigures, particularly for interacting with construction sets, is that they are not miniature action figures. Right. Miniature action figures are an entirely different thing. You give them articulation so they can do things, because they're standalone figures. The joy of the Lego minifigure, and even like character buildings kind of versions, is you can pick it up with one hand and you can plunk it down. You don't have to worry about legs splaying out or arms splaying out. It's a very simple, robust design for young children to old people in cupboards, because that's where we put them. Anyway, to build it up. So you pick up this figure and you put it down in your arms, you go. And the main estimate for how crap the Creo minifigures are is that every bugger who bought a set got the Transformer ones and played with them and loved them, and no one even built up the human ones. And I'm sorry, I refuse to accept anyone ever actually enjoyed the human minifigures. And if you did, you don't exist.
Okay, so you kind of went off on a little bit of a tangent.
No. I finished my tangent. But anyway, so Creo. So I had them. I didn't like them. I got rid of them. And then I tried the box shots, the Transformers box shots, and they were great fun for about 5 minutes. And then I realised that it was just the same toy over and over. Also, a new Shockwave one was coming out, and if I didn't get rid of them, I'd buy the Shockwave one. If I bought the Shockwave one, I'd buy them all. So I got rid of them. So I'm completely cured. The only Transformer I've then since acquired was reissue Sound Blaster, which was a gift from our friend Toy Fu, very kindly. He kept the tapes and he gave me the robot, and it's very nice indeed. I quite enjoy it. But anyway, so people have insinuated that I've replaced Transformers with Lego, which is complete lies.
Okay, so you can't see this, but you have a bookcase.
Yes.
Which has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 shelves.
That's correct. Yeah.
How many shelves have books and DVDs on them?
Well, there's a few.
We'll charitably say 3.5.
Okay.
And that's a combination of books and DVDs. Mm-hmm. How many have Lego?
Three and a half, Andy.
Just solely for the Lego. What is one of the tables in your room got covered in?
It's got some Lego people and vehicles.
Does it have anything other than Lego or boxes of Lego that needs to be opened and assembled?
There's a collected edition of the Transformers Titan comics, which I've never opened.
It's a little digest thing. Yeah. It's not taking up a huge amount of space. What's on the other table?
Grand Maximus from the Transformers.
And Sound Blaster. And what else?
There's the character building TARDIS, 101 minifigure Daleks, and the Dalek Factory.
And?
There's the Millennium Falcon Lego.
And?
There's a Lego dump truck, Lego caravan, about 20 Lego minifigures, Swamp Creature, all the Olympic ones, a couple of Space Marines, Lego Batman, some Lego Kingdom stuff, few wee things. and there's some over on that bookshelf as well. And there's some in the cupboard, there's some at the back of the cupboard, and also there's lots of minifigures which are actually in boxes in the cupboard that I need to sort out. And I've got this, there's the Lego Star Wars character encyclopedia over there.
With the legend that is Black Ewok.
Yes, and I've got the other Lego book somewhere in that pile. I didn't get rid of it.
Okay, yeah. So safe to say, everything for Lego. So
anyway, so the point is, sort of give it that, and again, we're talking about going on trips and social interaction and all this kind of business. Something a bit different for a change. I went to the Great Western Lego Show in Swindon Town just last week. And it was very good, and I lost my mind. Now, I'd recommend it to anyone. What was nice about it was that it wasn't just all dudes. A lot of these things are sausage fests, which is fine. I was going to say anyway, but it's all good. What's good about the Lego show is there's lots of women there as well, which is nice, and you know, families and stuff, so you don't feel so kind of, you know, sausaged, I suppose, whatever the phrase is, for going to these things. Anyway, and it's very good. And they had a Lego wheelchair, which was orange. And it could hold up to 900 kilograms of person. And there was a woman sitting on it, and she was moving it around. It was the most extraordinary thing. But the best thing was that the world's first Lego wheelchair has a cup holder, so the person in the wheelchair can have a beverage. That was really good. There was a T1 Terminator robot, which was moving around and targeting people from the third Terminator film. Rather than machines.
Oh, the drone thing.
Yeah, the kind of drone thing, yeah. But built up a wee bit with tank treads, whatever. And it was 2 meters tall, 1 meter wide. It's the largest Lego robot in the world. And they had all the Thunderbird vehicles, Thunderbird 3 and 2 and the other ones. And what was particularly good was Terrahawks, because we like Terrahawks. Well, rather, we like
the idea. Concept.
Yeah, Terrahawks is one of those shows that we loved in the 80s and can't really watch now. I can admire the craft, but anyway, the best thing about Terrahawks were the spheroid robot dudes, who were part of the good guys. Part of the good guys, who would battle the evil, and then the evil lot had like the equivalent, which were evil cubes. And at the end of every episode of Terrahawks, there would be a little nuts and crosses board would appear, and the Zeroids and the cubes would battle it out. And a chap made a giant Zeroid with lit up eyes, which was quite cool, and he made smaller ones in the cubes, and he let you play about with them. And make the nuts and crosses game, which made Andy very jealous when I sent him text about it. But he's a man, he can take it. So anyway, so that was very good. It's end of the year, I would say go to it. I'm now going to go to Legoland Windsor next year at some point, because I'm not addicted to Lego in any way at all. And we'll have a look at that. So I was just talking about social interaction and this type of hobby. So talking of that side of the hobby, we should move on to examining some piece of tat.
Yes.
What piece of tat do you have for this?
Okay, so I'm going for a comic from the space year 1986.
Ooh.
Specifically, the week 13th, or sorry, the weeks 13th to 26th of December
1986.
Ooh, that was eight. About nine at that point.
Yeah. Jeez. Just to put us in the context, this is roughly around about the time that Transformers the movie came out in UK cinemas.
It would actually be, yes, yeah. It's that year. This is Target 2006 is wrapped up. We're steamrolling ahead towards the great mystery of issue 100 and mm-hmm. what happened to Optimus Prime and Co. when they were in limbo, which we're not actually going to talk about because it's not that comic. It is, of course, it's an issue of Oink, number 17.
What was Oink?
Oink was a comic, I believe I just covered that a moment ago.
What kind of comic was Oink?
Oink, to be perfectly honest, is a comic unlike anything else. It's comics to generally for the anybody who obviously didn't live through this era of it, comics tend to go through preschool, licensed toys, superhero was sort of kind of the Marvel style route, mm-hmm. was kind of your progression towards as you went up. Now, you kind of also had the DC Thompson IPC, which is what Oink was from Fleetway IPC, kind of had the kiddie stuff, your Beano, your Dandy, and all that Victor Warlord and stuff. Yeah. Then you would kind of go to 2000 AD possibly, or there, and kind of at the other, at the fair sort of adult end of that spectrum would be Viz, to be perfectly honest, because it was based on the style of DC Thompson IPC comics. Oink is the missing link between between traditional comics and Viz, to be perfectly honest, because it's kid friendly, but it's absolute mental. It's sheer unrestrained anarchy. It was unlike anything that was on the shelves at that point in time. The level of cartooning wasn't always sort of a DC Thompson, because he had a level of craft and everything that was there.
Yes.
A polish and a sheen to most of the work, which made it look good on the one hand, but also kind of sanitised it a little bit. This was just people had random styles and just chucked shit down, literally. It's not to say it wasn't good, but it was basically, there wasn't anything like this on the shelves.
No.
And it stood out. And you had Charlie Brooker cut his teeth cartooning on this before you go on to
this.
Newswipe, Scream Wipe, and the various other things.
That looks like Dan Dare.
Yes, they did have a Dan Dare pastiche. Now, obviously, the comic's called Oink, so you can tell that there's a certain porcine quality to it.
Indeed.
And that's kind of what it is. It was edited in essence by Uncle Pig.
What one might even say is proctacular? Maybe not.
It's fine. Oh! But you had Ham Dare. Now, this was actually written by cartoonist and all-rounded top bloke, Lou Strip.
Yeah.
No stranger to readers and fans of Transformers for his work on Robo Capers, Comeback Colin, and the like.
Indeed.
And Brickman.
Yeah.
He wrote it, and it was done, the art was done by JT Dog, which I assume is a pseudonym for someone whose name I'm criminally unaware of.
Unless there really is someone called JT Dog, but I would find it unlikely.
Now, it's done in a pastiche of, it's got the best looking art in the comic, because it was done deliberately as a pastiche of the old Frank Hampson.
Frank Hampson and his studio did Dan Dare. It's also in full colour, which is Oink as well, is again from the era of comics where you had a mixture of colour and black and white, and also pages that were done all in one colour
or two colours sometimes you'd have, so it would be process colours, and it basically says they're all very short strips, one, two pages, sometimes even multiple strips to a page. It's basically, it's designed because it's humour. Not everything's going to be to everybody's taste.
Yeah.
So the thing about that was always a page is a lot of real estate for a humour comic, certainly in British times anyway.
Yeah,
so,
and indeed a page should be a lot of real estate for any comic, really.
But particularly with humour, because if you're not funny, or you're not getting, if you're not to my sense of humour early on, and I've got pages on pages to read, you've lost your reader. Whereas if you've got three strips and a page, fantastic. One might not be for you, might go to the next one, and go through all the way through.
Yeah, because I would say the general rule of thumb for any humour-based comic or publication is that it needs to make you laugh or be amused at least half the time to make you come back. Because you know, you always know with these things you're going to get a mixed bag. And to be honest, that's part of the fun. The fun of these type of things is that you'll turn the page, and it's not just that you'll have a completely different story, but through Oink, so that my memories of it, flicking through it again just now, is that it's the variety of art styles as well. They're, like, although there's a sort of animal type theme, the style of artwork varies enormously from page to page, like even during a page at times.
Yes, because you can have the Uncle Pig, the person who did the illustration, mostly Uncle Pig did some strips of kind of what was going on in the office, and had kind of a kind of Quentin Blake kind of look to it.
Yeah, I would say there's a bit of Quentin Blake in there, yeah. Probably deliberately so.
I'd imagine so. And then you had sort of people doing, like, the cartoonist Banks doing ones, which Lou Stringer did some strips, he did Tom Thug.
Yeah. It's one that's a takeoff of Adrian Mole,
yeah,
which was one of those books by Sue Townsend.
Yes.
Sue Townsend did these books, The Secret Diaries of Adrian Mole, in the sort of 80s and 90s, which this piss take of Adrian Mole would work particularly well on me, because I detested Adrian Mole, because it was one of those things that I was always told, you must, like, you are a child and you're an entireness, so just go on! And people's voices would get really deep when they talked about it, because they were convinced it was amazing, but it wasn't.
It showed kind of the superheroes. There was, like, Rubbish Man, which you done by Hal Dane, who kind of has Cyclops visor and a strange superhero suit, but it was all designed to be just absolutely
Christmas cards you can cut out. You've got a sort of piss take of film and radio listings of the time
from the Pocshire region.
Indeed. Yes. Featuring such DJs as John Beale,
Steve Fright,
yeah,
And also you get the James Bond film, which is quite a snuck under the radar there.
Yes.
You also have Airwolf.
Yep.
Which is another exciting repeat involving the awesome high-tech hot air balloon, Airwolf.
Indeed. We also have Xmas on the Planet of the Apes, which is something I really want to see now.
Blind Daft with Cilla Black.
Yeah. 3, 2, 1 and a half, which related to a TV show at the time called 3, 2, 1 with Dustin Abandon.
Simon Bates' Xmas visit.
That sounds creepy.
It does.
In more ways than one.
Yes. And you, a piss take of the A Christmas Tale with Poor Woodcutter by Christian Feetnerson.
Mm-hmm.
Which has explosives.
It does.
Yeah.
You can buy your own merchandise.
You can be a pig pal and join the pig pack.
I'd like to join the pig pack.
You could get a traditional t-shirt featuring a porky portrait of the great Uncle Pig.
Oh.
Designed in Porky Pig.
How do I join?
You're an adult, so you have to send $5.25
Oh.
That's for just for your t-shirt.
Oh.
Oh, if you want to join the pig pack, you need to send it £1.12.
I can afford that. I often wonder that actually when you see old comics and publications for old fan clubs and gifts, you know, just for shits and giggles, should they just send off at it and see what happens? Now, I know that in reality all that would happen is your letter would go to the dead letter office and never go anywhere, but I always like to hope that sometime
it gets passed along
somewhere, and you might get a wee letter back from the comic or something, or you might get to join things like Rail Riders, the exciting rail club for children of the 80s, which I was in. Which is very exciting because you've got stickers and things. Kind of like what you had in the Oink there. Now, Oink was one of those comics that when you're 8 years old, as I was, Oink felt incredibly subversive and slightly dodgy. It's like, whoa, I shouldn't be reading this kind of comic. So it was actually a comic I would buy in stealth because the local newsagent, which was the only place that sold it, one local newsagent, which was also the only place which you could get Marvel US comics, random issues, which is where I got my first Fantastic Four and Hulk issues. And they were the only places with Oink. And the thing about Oink was they put Oink beside the dirty magazines. as I call them, the dirty magazines. So you had to go in when you were 8, right, and pretend I was going to get like He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, which I would get. And then I would shuffle over to where all the dodgy ladies' magazines were with their boobies and things, you know, all hanging out and stuff, and then I'd have to reach under them because that's where Oink was and sort of put them in. And then I would put Oink inside, well, I'll pay for it obviously, you know. Then I'd go outside and I'd put it inside the He-Man comic or Transformers or whatever, and then read it because it just seemed so incredibly rude. Now, it's one of those things, it's like, had I been a year or two older, I'd probably just go, it's just a comedy thing, but for some reason it just felt like the filthiest thing in the world.
I think deliberately, yeah. The way that it was put together does.
Yeah, which is kind of going back to what we banged on about before, which is something that's currently lacking a wee bit in the comic newsstands of the UK is you've got a lot of stuff aimed at very young children and stuff aimed at teenagers, and not a lot in between. Although hopefully the rise of digital will see changes to that. So like Dandy go digital.
But it's a case of it's absolutely bonkers.
Mm.
Your mileage on the strips will vary, to be perfectly honest, because it's an anthology, but it's quite dense. To be perfectly honest, a lot of the slightly more deliberately ugly cartooning does kind of put me off a little bit.
Yeah.
In terms of, I find it now, reading it back,
mm-hmm.
It's just, you kind of go, you could still tell that story, but be a little bit more polished with it. Lou Stringer's work, obviously, still as amazing as it always is.
Very distinctive.
You always know. So he does obviously Satan the Cat, Tom Thug, Pete the Spimple, and obviously writes Ham Dare.
Indeed.
In this case, it's not a comic that appears a lot in back issues that you're trying to find.
It's also not a comic that that people tend to remember. It seems to be, I don't know if it had bad distribution. I know it didn't have a huge, how long did it last for?
I think it certainly got about, I think 50, 60
something
years
like maybe. That, yeah, but
it got a couple of years out of it. It was there, but yeah, it just kind of,
oh, we also had a photo strip
in one of the issues, yeah, but no, it was just kind of one of these things that it just seemed to kind of, it vanished. Obviously a lot of the people went on to other things, but it's not really fated as much in the UK, yeah, seen as it should do. I mean, I can understand our sort of American listeners going to go on, what the hell is this?
Indeed.
But it's a case of, it's really distinct, and it's kind of one of these comics that if you can find issues, track them down and give it a read. I mean, it's not going to be for everybody, but just kind of to get a flavour for kind of how mental sometimes comics could be for kids, because it's absolutely bonkers. I mean, it doesn't quite work, doesn't obviously have the impact now being the ages that we are,
yeah.
But you kind of look at it and go, bloody hell, they just chucked indeed madness at it. It's one of these things that doesn't appear to have had, again, it's from IPC, who were quite draconian in their editing. Is if you were to consult things such as David Bishop's excellent account of 2000 AD's history, Throw Power Overload, who talks at length of some of the censorship issues and difficulties they had with IPC hierarchy, it boggles my mind that Oink gets out there for kids, because again, there's not a huge amount of like violence in it, yeah. But it is kind of very close to the knuckle a lot of the times in terms of the humour and the gags.
Indeed it is.
So I recommend these are the issues I've managed to get at. Actually snagged them at the last one, my informal gathering.
It's almost like a time loop, a reverse of occlusion, no doubt.
I got these just before you did, along with the Captain Planet special.
We don't talk about that.
It's one of these things that if you can track down issues, and good luck to you finding them, give it a go. I mean, as I say, the loose stringer stuff holds up the best, as does Hand Air, which obviously is written by Lewis, who I'd say that's the strongest material in it, certainly to me. But it's worth it. But it's just, as I say, it's quite mental that this got out under eye.
Yeah,
you can only think it just floated under the radar enough for a while.
Yeah, pretty much. But talking of under the radar and things being awesome and the like, at this point we have to refer to something which is not awesome.
And is under the radar for a lot.
It does under the radar for a lot of people.
Lucky bastards.
Now, about context here, before we move on to our featured...
Feature presentation.
Now, in the space year 2012, Doctor Who is in its 49th year.
And it is arguably as popular as it's ever been.
Yes, 5 episodes have recently aired, and if you look at the final figures for the BBC One showing, add on the BBC Three showing, and add on the iPlayer links, each of these 5 episodes has had over 9 million people watching them. That's not bad for a 49-year-old TV show. And also, it's in its 8th year since it came back. Now, thinking about it now, it's inconceivable almost to think back to those strange, lonely years when it was off the telly, but it was. And while it was off the telly between 1989 and 1996 and 96 to 2005, various things filled the void, all of which were official. We're talking about unofficial things here. Between 1996 and 2005, by that point, the audio dramas by Big Finish were...
Well, it was 1999,
...were not starting off yet. They were not starting off yet. But there were some radio shows. You had Paradise of Death and Ghosts of End Space. So you had that in terms of your stuff. And you had all the books from Virgin.
And then BBC Books.
And then BBC going on. And then after the TV movie in 96, all these things, the audios went up and going and things like that. But there was a strange sort of twilight period between about 1987, when the show was still on the air, starting with Wartime, the exciting drama featuring Sergeant Benton, which we may have talked about before, and up until about 1999-2000, when they fizzled out, where what we're talking about are the actual official licensed Doctor Who spin-off videos.
Now, what we should talk about is Doctor Who... not so much Doctor Who, but BBC had contracts, and the way it works is in terms of how if people were creating original creations for the programme. It's why it's inconceivable now that someone like Terry Nation would create the Daleks for a show like Doctor Who and own them.
Yeah.
But he does, he just doesn't own the design, the look, the
language. Yeah, I mean, things have changed. For instance, if you look at what is one of the creatures is arguably now a rival for the Daleks, certainly amongst the affection of children, the Weeping Angels,
yes,
were created by Stephen Moffat, but you'll never see a credit on any of the shows that says Weeping Angels created by Stephen Moffat. So presumably the BBC own them.
Work for hire,
and they can do what it's like. But as Andy says, previously, you could do it. So for some of the audio dramas, sort of before Big Finish had the official Doctor Who license, there were a few kicking around late 90s featuring things like the Zygons, and Sontarans, there was a Rani one, things like that, and they went away. But basically, what kind of what was happening into them were the video spin-offs. Now, what kind of killed them off were basically you could then Big Finish more or less killed them off, because the thing is you can do you then had officially licensed stuff with the Doctor, which nobody could get the license for in video, and even though they're low budget, they sound fine.
And I think also the other thing was at that point the BBC VHS range kind of ramped into into gear, which it's impossible to think of now, but even I would say even the mid, I think really was the McGann movie that kind of got BBC Worldwide to think we should pump some of this stuff out.
Yeah, and also all the Doctor Who stuff was on UK Gold.
Yep.
So people could get, so between that and the VHS, people could access it. But also, even though there was the VHS tapes and UK Gold, not everyone had money for VHS tapes, or to buy them all, or even the interest, or had access to UK Gold. So there was still a healthy appetite out there, particularly when, although they were the audio visuals unofficial, in terms of Doctor Who audio, the appetite was we wanted to see things on screen, because by that point Doctor Who was something that was either on television, or the book,
yes,
or a comic. So there were a few unofficial ones kicking around. And there were also things like The Stranger. The Air Zone Solution, where you had either Doctor Who actors in them and sold it to the fan base as, look, here's a new thing with Peter Davis in it. Or The Stranger, here's a thing where Colin Baker is sort of playing a Doctor and Nicola Bryant has sort of been Peri, but we've changed the names and some of the details around a bit. So they're not quite, but they can be if you want them to be, sort of thing. So anyway, that's a long ramble by way of introduction, because not everyone knows these exist, they are a bit obscure.
And as I say, so what people could do is basically contact either the creators or the estates in some cases of the original creators and get the rights to use them and to pay for them. So again, relatively cheaper when you were doing sort of taking the monsters, because it's basically you just then build your suit or
you could buy the rights to characters like the Brigadier or Sarah,
which
Jane
is where it becomes more expensive, because you then have to go and get the actors. So again, there was, or you get ones like Cyberon, which is just about the Cybermen with the serial numbers filed off.
So the main sort of perpetrators were
Keith Barnfather in real time
and Bill Baggs video were the sort of two main. There was also Dreamwatch Productions and the like.
DWB Gary Lee Cockbag.
Indeed. So by the mid-90s there was a healthy market in these, particularly as the chances of it coming back, Doctor Who being back in TV, were not very high.
Especially after the McGann era.
That was seen as basically the last boat, basically. So for many years these were hard to come by, because they've long since been put out of print. And generally, they either don't have the license to put them in DVD anymore, or they don't have the footage for good enough quality, or maybe there's just not enough interest. The only sort of things that turn up on DVD now are the Mythmakers videos from BBV, which was a series of interviews with various Doctor Who people, done by the likes of Nick Briggs. Whatever happened to him?
Yeah.
But what's happened in the last couple of years, I've noticed, is that a lot of these productions have appeared on YouTube, and they don't seem to be getting taken down, so either the copyright owners for them are not too fussed about having them up anymore because they can't make any money off them, or they don't care, or whatever. But you can now, should you do some research, find out about these amazing productions and then go on a voyage to YouTube. So I've been, Mr. Turnbull here is a newcomer to this exciting spin-off world of Doctor Who.
Yes, so we've done the Benton one.
Wartime.
Watched some horrible documentary about Is Doctor Who Sexist?
Lust in Space, it was called.
Fucking awful.
Which featured Mark Strickson, not as Turlow, but as a Time Lord chap.
Yeah.
Nicholas Courtney, not as the Brigadier, but also as another Time Lord chap, who were plucking people from time and space, including Uncle Terwin Six, to give evidence for the prosecution or the defence as to whether Doctor Who was a sexist programme or not.
Intense.
It is as bad as it sounds.
Terrible bollocks.
But one of the more famous ones, which we're going to talk about to round off this podcast, I think, is called Downtime. Now, Downtime is notable for certain things. First of all, it has a professional writer associated with Doctor Who doing the script, which was Mark Platt, as a professional director associated with Doctor Who, Christopher Barry, directing it. It features the licensed characters played by the original actors of Victoria Waterfield, Sarah Jane Smith, and the Brigadier, as well as Professor Travers from The Abominable Snowman and The Web of Fear on television, and The Yeti and The Great Intelligence. Also features the likes of Jeffrey Beavers, who was the master and keeper of tracking, as a homeless hobo. John Leeson, who was the first K-9, voice of K-9, as a radio DJ in the university. And Miles Richardson, who's an actor who's popped up in lots of these things, and is better known as Irvine Braxiatel in Big Finish Audios, a Time Lord chap in the Benny series.
Isn't he Ian Richardson's son as well?
I believe so, yes. Yeah. And a few other kind of bit parts where you'll go, oh, it's so-and-so or so-and-so.
Basically, what Ralph's trying to say to you in a roundabout way is, people who should know better.
Yes, yes. It's also the one that's probably more likely to be watched, because people go, it's got the Brigadier, it's got Sarah Jane Smith, it's got the Yeti, it's got proper director, proper writer. Let's go for it.
You're asking yourself, how with all of these magical, mystical ingredients can it go so badly wrong?
Well, let's tell you the opening scene. And then I'll let Andy tell you the plot. Wow. I've been talking too much, Andy. But I'll tell you the opening scene. The opening scene is in Tibet, I believe, somewhere. And Victoria Waterfield, looking quite young, so they've applied lots of heavy makeup to Deborah Watling, who, no disrespect, was, you know, 20-odd years older at the time. Almost 30 years older when this was made. And everyone ages. Anyway, she's there, and then we hear Pat, the voice of the Great Intelligence doing stuff.
Jimmy chanting that Ralph likes to do it.
Hum, humdy, humdy, hum, humdy, humdy. Which is actually reused from Planet of the Spiders. The chant they use, not actually from Abominable Snowman. Ho, ho, multiple layers. Anyway, so she appears, she's looking for her father who's went missing. The Great Intelligence voice is doing spooky stuff. Jimmy Bree, Keeper of the Matrix.
Yes.
As well as featured in the War Games. He appears, gets covered in some sort of web spooge. Says, don't go on any further. Now, while you're watching this, it's staged, it's filmed like a stage production. People just side in from the left. The lighting's really bad. The sound is bad. And this is the opening to your film. Tell us more about the plot, Andy.
Alright, so you then cut to what looks like some industrial estate in Berlin in the 70s. It doesn't look too about miles away from the fourth planet, the fourth Planet of the Apes film,
yes,
with the cityscape, except considerably pisher lit and cheap. It's got a whole host of lunatics in t-shirts and some sort of strange cult.
They're called Chilies. Because they chill out.
So they're there.
Yeah, it's a university.
And so you've got the DJ with John Leeson narrating it, being the worst DJ in Doctor Who history, even worse than Alexei Sale in Revelation.
Yeah.
Talking about how there's strange things going on, blah blah blah. In the head complex of the Chili's, you've got Sarah Jane Smith in her role as plucky investigative reporter, is there to meet with the head.
Who turns out to be
Victoria
Waterfield. And an evil chap with a jumper.
Who just looks like the fucking IT supervisor. He tries to be ominous and threatening a number of times and just comes across like, if you said that to me in any office environment, you'd be told, get to fuck.
It just comes across like a CBBC version of a paedophile, to be honest, more than anything else. And I know it's not intended, but every time he comes on with his chunky jumper and his eye of evil, and the way he sort of minces toward people, you're just going, Poundland pedo, Poundland pedo.
Now, they're looking for, she's doing it because she thinks there's something suspicious going on with these people as she's there. Now, they're searching for an artifact.
Yes.
Now, the thing is, she is not the head of the company. She's presented as kind of like a chief executive.
The head is, well, who could that be?
Oh, good. Whoa. It's going to be Professor Travers.
Possessed by the Great Intelligence, perhaps.
So that kind of goes on. The Chilies are kind of indoctrinating people, wearing stupid earphones and the like. Basically, the Brigadier gets embroiled in this.
Yes.
Now, it makes no sense. There's Sarah Jane Smith in it at the start and pretty much is superfluous. She doesn't need to be there.
She vanishes after the opening scene when she goes and she speaks to Victoria Waterfield and the Pound Stretcher Pedo, and then she vanishes and then she reappears at the end. In fact, I'd forgotten she was in it by the time she reappeared. So you've got the Yeti control spheres, there's some sort of plan to take over the world, which is not entirely explained. There's some sort of cult thing going on.
Brigadier's having hallucinations.
Yeah, he's been contacted on the astral plane by a student of this university who is sort of killed off because he was trying to expose the Chilis and so on. But all of this goes on and eventually results in a very disappointing ending with very little actual Yeti action. The Yeti not only are hardly in it, but when they're in it, they appear and just stand there. Which is daft because they've got the costumes. You may as well use them. But the most notable aspect of Downtime, and why I suspect its views on YouTube may have shot up in recent weeks, is that a real episode of Doctor Who aired called The Power of the Three. Now, what was significant about The Power of the Three is it introduced a sort of new head for UNIT, who hopefully will become a recurring character because she's set up to be.
And they've cast a very good actress.
They've cast a sort of good actress for her, and she seems up for it. She's called Kate Stewart, and it's implied she is the daughter of Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart. Kate Stewart originated from Downtown, fact fans.
Yes.
That's where they get the reference from.
It's well, just to correct, it's not that it's implied. It's implied at the start. You're kind of thinking, is this going to be? And I was, while this was going on, exchanging some Twitter DMs with Matt Thornton, oh my god, could this be? Is this actually going to be? And then it's like, so you drop the Lethbridge bit at the end. So they're like, nope. So they brought a horrific, horrific spin off into continuity. Look for it on a Blu-ray of Doctor
Who. Now, this is also from the period where some of these spin offs were novelised. Along with Shakedown, Return of the Disenchanted, Downtime was novelised and featured cameos from the second Doctor at the start and the third Doctor at the end, if I remember rightly. And is not good but readable. And it's better because you don't have to put up with, well, all the acting and stuff.
Because aside from Jeffrey Beavers and the Brigadier, there is nobody on screen who is any good.
No. I mean, Nick Courtney is the only thing that got me through that because yes. he's not only still acting his little cotton socks off, but he's also still being the Brigadier. He's obviously older by this point, he's, you know, larger, maybe not as physically active, but he's still doing the part very well. He's very watchable, he's very good, and every moment he's on screen, I could take less vodka.
Well,
when he was off the screen, no.
And now, long-time listeners of the podcast and acquaintances of mine will know that for years, I have singled out a Who person as probably one of the worst actors I've ever had to sit through any of their work. I speak, of course, of Carol Ann Ford.
Who was perfectly decent on Doctor Who. I've explained this to you.
And again, as I said, because she's with, basically, Hartnell spot on as the Doctor as he's portrayed at that point, which is a distinctly different character from the Doctor as he goes on, but there you go. But is on screen with William Russell and
The other one
who plays Carol. Both of us.
This is oh look, I'm so ashamed I've dropped something.
Is it Jacqueline
Hill? And I am never allowed to talk about Doctor Who ever again.
Now, so she kind of shares a lot of her scenes with the two of them, who are arguably two of the best actors and actresses that were in Doctor Who. So whenever she's on screen, she drags them down.
No, she doesn't.
She does, that's my opinion,
no,
and it's right.
You're
anyway,
wrong.
Let's move on. I now, however, having watched Downtime, have rescinded that.
Deborah
Watling is excruciating.
She is
watch.
Absolutely terrible. She is horrific.
They've given her 80s Dynasty power suit, her hair's all bunched back, the plastic surgery and heavy slap makeup and soft focus lightning. Lightning would have been fucking good if it struck her and stopped her from doing that. But she is awful.
Yeah.
It's this clipped, harsh tone she's trying to take to say, I'm in charge.
Yeah.
It's like, fucks, you can't emote. You can't be credible. You are like a cardboard Davros.
If you want to imagine what she's like, if you're of a certain vintage, you may recall the 35th anniversary VHS release special of the Ice Warriors, which featured a VHS special second tape, which was a documentary on the missing episodes of Doctor Who. This was later slightly updated and put on the Lost in Space DVD set. And you may recall her, shall we say, distinctive method of presentation. Yes, imagine that, but acting in a drama. I mean, bless her. I thought she was, you know, for what she did in Doctor Who in the 60s, which was to scream a lot. She was fine. She did the job. I didn't mind her. She's not good in this, but it's not the worst ever Watling performance by a country mile. Ooh, no, no, no. The worst performance is in a big Finnish audio called Power Play, where she meets the Sixth Doctor, where every time she speaks, you want to claw your ears out.
I have as yet not listened to that, and based on your ringing endorsement, I'm hardly likely to be a part of that.
Oh, I can give you.
I'm sure you can.
It's on my download folder on the Big Finish website, and they allow you to download as many copies of your
podcasts as you like. I have other audios to get through first.
You think so? Yes, now, on the one hand, I could be kind to downtime, because I could say, well, look at the context we're watching it in. We are not 1995, at least not mentally. And we didn't.
I'm always 1995. I'm usually Generation 2, Issue 5, UK for life.
Very good. We didn't buy the VHS. We viewed it for free, and also, you know, you have to take in context at the times that these productions were done with very limited resources and very limited budgets. And I could say all these things, and I could be entirely fair. However, it's still a great big tea bag and pile of shite.
Well, the thing is, I can say. You can say that, but here's the thing. I could forgive all that if the performances were good. And as we said, aside from Jeffrey Beavers and the Big Deer, there isn't a good performance there. Again, the late Elizabeth Sladen, she didn't really have anything to do, so she's not going to give a performance. She was given...
Yeah, she's...
She didn't get... She was given
She's not bad. I mean, we're not saying that she turns up and does a bad turn.
But she does nothing. She's there to ask a couple of quick questions at the start and to kind of help set a scene.
And there she's really there to turn up at the end and say, look... The enemy's been defeated. I'll write about it.
So that's it. So she's not going to be able to do anything. So there's no knock against Liz Clayton.
So, as we finish an exciting summary of Downtime and this most Halloween of Halloween podcasts you've ever learned, obviously all the references to Halloween, if you're really clever, if you're one of the special people, the special, special people, you will have heard all the links to Halloween. Because it's like an audio magic eye picture. If you've got the special senses, you can see the picture.
If you can play this backwards, you will hear.
If you're not one of the special people, and you thought, wait a second, none of the items they've discussed have any relation to Halloween whatsoever, then you will have to figure out how to hear them.
And if you play it backwards, all I can say is any similarity to the Jim will Fix It theme tune is entirely coincidental.
So, that's fixed it. Now then, let's move on to the double cliffhanger of this podcast. Yes, that's right, because even though it'll be a while before you hear the next one, in the next exciting episode, you will hear these three exciting things. First of all, you will hear about
Transformers Retro Generation 1, the Birmingham Informal Gathering 4 official fanzine, which I contributed to, so I will review the bits I didn't. Ralph will review the bits I did, because otherwise I would just say... Oh, that's awful. That's awful.
Second exciting cliffhanger segment is I'm going to make Andy Turnbull watch the remake of Footloose from 2011.
Also, you're going to find out how our homemade strawberry vodka daiquiris went.
Last exciting cliffhanger.
So four.
We do.
Four will be fantastic. Four to Doomsday.
The last exciting cliffhanger is that, and this relates back to Downtime in the World of Doctor
Who.
I have found it on YouTube.
Oh, it's not Doctor Who porn, is it?
I have found, sadly not. I have found possibly the most obscure.
I'm actually frightened.
It's one of the most obscure.
I'm actually scared.
And also, possibly the most terrible spin-off of all. Now, to put it in the context, I watched a couple of minutes of it and thought, I'm not watching this alone. And saved it.
If it's the ones with the Centaurians, I've seen that.
I speak of Soul's Ark.
I've never heard of this.
Most people haven't. That's the beauty of it. So, we're about to experience these things, and then once we have them, we'll come back and talk about them. Goodbye.
I'd just like to say, all these things seem to revolve around me. This is a horrifically abusive relationship.
Because, again, this relates to Operation Manimal Silence.
Is it because I made you watch an episode of Manimal?
What was supposed to happen on a previous podcast, your listeners, was that Andy was supposed to get his gift of the Animal DVDs. Manimal, I don't know who Animal is.
He's in the Legion of Doom as well.
Yes.
Ah, what a rush!
The Manimal DVD. What was supposed to happen is, he was supposed to watch the Manimal DVD and go, oh dear, it's one of those things I loved as a child, it doesn't hold up. But instead, his joy remains unconfined. So we found all these things to punish him with. We're going to now do these things, and then, depending on how these activities go, we'll record a podcast later today or possibly tomorrow and let you know what it's about. So, in the meantime, you can find me on Twitter at Stardubbing.
You can find me on Twitter at Andrew D. Turnbull.
We are on iTunes.
Yes.
We are at the Nerdsphere Forum.
And Full Metal Hero as well. And
as well as the Transmasters UK Forum.
And also you can find us at our luxurious website.
What's that called?
It's located at, it's startupful enough, the name of the podcast, located at http://www.star-dub.com.
What else is on that website other than this fantastic podcast?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. More
cornucopia of delights.
It's true. At the moment, we're running through the second volume of the Daily Straxus, a daily web comic where, there are, again, as you get the idea, there's a new one every day. The ongoing adventures of Lord Straxus, Decepticon Head in the Bowl. It's set somewhere between Target 2006 and the events of Prime going back to Cybertron and Prey.
Amazing.
It has had some input from Mr. Burns.
Indeed.
And again, if you just check on the website, 9 o'clock in the morning, there's new ones are up.
That's right. Bunk off from work and look at this website instead.
It's true. So, it will enrich your life, if not your payback.
Goodbye.
Farewell.